President Trump has certainly signaled that he wants a deal. So I think that's the basis for optimism. And the consistent statements from both sides suggest that there's going to be progress as well.
Optimism on the possibility of a U.S.-China trade deal. This is Thursday, May 2nd, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Also ahead, a new emperor ascends to the Japanese throne. Increased worry by artists as talks with the Taliban continue. And talking about Huawei cost a British official his job. All on today's VOA Asia. American and Chinese trade negotiators met Wednesday for talks on their bruising tariff war after Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said the U.S. side might be moving toward a decision on whether to make a deal with Beijing. Wednesday's atmosphere appeared amicable. Mnuchin and U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer, along with China's economic czar, Vice Premier Liu He, smiled for photos, shook hands after the one-day meeting. After the meeting, Mnuchin said the two countries completed productive talks in Beijing, but they didn't say anything to reporters and no details were announced after the talks at the Chinese government guesthouse. Both governments have said they are making progress that has helped to calm some jittery financial markets. Joining us on VOA Asia is Jeff Moon. He was the assistant trade representative in the Obama administration, and he's now an international trade consultant. Jeff, thanks for being with us. As we just said, there were smiles on both sides of these talks in Beijing. Do you think there is really room for increased optimism, or was that just for show?
I think it's a little bit of both. These officials are all professionals that have been doing international business transactions for a long time, and they know how to project appropriate optimism, which their governments want to project. President Trump has certainly signaled that he wants a deal, so I think that's the basis for optimism. And the consistent statements from both sides suggest that there's going to be progress as well.
What does it take, and what is it taking for a deal to be completed?
Well, there are a variety of issues that are out there on the table. There are purchases to reduce the trade deficit. There are market openings the U.S. is seeking, changes in China's industrial policy reforms. And then, of course, there's enforcement on any agreements that are there. So there are a number of issues that are out there. I think that they have made a lot of progress on purchases, not so much on market openings. A lot remains to be discussed about industrial policy reforms. And most of the press attention and a lot of attention of the negotiators is on enforcement. Not entirely clear what it is they're going to be enforcing, but they've been talking about a mechanism and consequences for enforcing things.
Well, you know, officials and businesses, they say China's failed to keep past promises concerning its trade practices. Is that still the number one worry that is on their minds?
Well, in my mind, we need to have commitments to enforce. So what's most important is that we get China to change some policies and behaviors. However, given our past experience, enforcement is important. And enforcement, in my mind, needs to consist of three elements. There needs to be a mechanism, there need to be benchmarks for measuring things, and there need to be consequences. As for benchmarks, we really can't know what the benchmarks are until we know what the commitments are. And then in terms of consequences, President Trump has been very interested in tariffs and has thought that that is a very persuasive mechanism. The big question is when and how the tariffs will be removed. U.S. negotiators are focusing on that because of President Trump's priority. But for China, the tariffs are important, too. That's the only thing that they actually get out of these talks is removing those tariffs. So the options are to remove the tariffs in phases or reduce the percentage value of the tariffs that are out there. And these are the points that are being discussed right now. There are some press reports that they've reached an agreement, but there are no official statements.
So in your view and your estimation, how long is this going to take?
I think certainly there's going to be another round next week, and then there will at a minimum be a few weeks more of negotiations. It will take time to prepare the papers involved. It's a 150-page document. I think that the most optimistic deadline would be at the end of June when there's going to be a G20 summit in Japan, and President Trump and Xi aren't going to be there. But President Trump has suggested that he would like to have a signing ceremony in the U.S. So I think it's going to take a while, and exactly where the signing will be will is up in the air.
We've been talking with Jeff Moon. He was assistant trade representative in the Obama administration. He's now an international trade consultant. Jeff, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now on voanews.com. Pakistan says a terrorist raid Wednesday from across the Afghanistan border killed at least three soldiers and injured seven others. The military's media wing says security forces were building a border fence in the remote North Waziristan district when a group of about 60 or 70 terrorists from the Afghan side assaulted them. A UN Security Council committee blacklisted the head of the Pakistan-based militant group Jaish-e-Mohammed. That after China dropped its objection to the move, ending a decade-long diplomatic impasse. Just days before his official coronation, Thailand's king Wednesday married the deputy head of his personal guard force and gave her a title, Queen Sothida. And India began evacuating hundreds of thousands of villages on Wednesday and shut down operations at two major ports on its east coast ahead of an impending cyclone expected to make landfall on Friday. VOA Asia continues. Japan's Emperor Naruhito promised to pray for the happiness of the people, as he formally ascended to the chrysanthemum throne Wednesday morning. In a solemn ceremony at the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, Naruhito accepted the symbols of the throne, including a sword and jewel, along with the seal of state and his personal imperial seal. In a brief speech shortly after receiving the royal paraphernalia, the new emperor said he was filled with a sense of solemnity and promised to emulate his father, Akihito, who abdicated the throne a day earlier. In acceding to the throne, he said, "I swear I will reflect deeply on the course followed by His Majesty, the Emperor Emeritus, and bear in mind the path trodden by past emperors, and will devote myself to self-improvement. I also swear that I will act according to the Constitution and fulfill my responsibility as the symbol of the state and of the unity of the people of Japan, while always turning my thoughts to the people and standing with them. I sincerely pray for the happiness of the people and the further development of the nation as well as the peace of the world." The emperor's wife, Empress Masako, was at his side during the speech but was barred from attending the first part of the ceremony, according to long-standing custom that only adult male royals could participate. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe instituted a policy back in 2012 called Womenomics, a plan to revive Japan's economy by getting more women back to work. One restaurant in Tokyo is a symbol of the steady progress toward closing the wide gender gap. Tsuro Takami is unlike most restaurants in Japan. It's run entirely by women. My VOA colleague Lori London talked with reporter Amy Gutman, who recently traveled to Japan, to learn more about it.
It's a highly paternalistic, traditional, conservative society that believes that women are really the caregivers of society and that they're there to look after the children, stay at home, not share parental tasks and housekeeping tasks with their husbands, but to take on the lion's share of it themselves, also care for aging parents. And there's also a work-to-death culture that still exists in Japan, where employees are expected to work incredibly long hours. This excludes women from going back to work, because if they've got kids, it's impossible to work until midnight, 1 a.m., etc.
How well known is it?
Womenomics is very well known within Japan, and we're starting to see a lot of changes finally taking root at the corporate level, at the government level. There's still a long way to go, but companies are instituting policies of more flex time. This is something that didn't exist in Japan until very recently. Telecommuting, this also didn't exist. More suitable hours for women who are coming back to work after having children, and also trying to share parental responsibilities. So a couple of years ago, it was unheard of for a man to leave early to go collect his child at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. That was something that was a woman's job. But now we're seeing more big companies try to adapt to this sharing of responsibilities and a more balanced approach to gender in Japan.
Why is this restaurant so special?
Japan remains a male-dominant society where women really struggle to acquire and be trained in leadership roles, particularly in places like kitchens where they can become chefs or run restaurants. So typically in Japan, you have male chefs and you have men running restaurants, even if you have women as members of the wait staff. It's been very difficult for women to prove themselves and find opportunities to run kitchens and restaurants. It is happening increasingly so, but it has for decades been very difficult and remains so. So this restaurant is unique because a well-established couple who own a string of other successful restaurants opened it some years ago specifically with the aim of cultivating female chefs and managers and really creating a sort of female leadership enterprise.
So is it working?
It is working. First of all, the restaurant, it should be said, has a name for itself representing kaseki, which is a multiple-course meal in Japanese haute cuisine, and it's presented in the most artistic way. It's a wonderful restaurant. It's consistently getting great reviews. It's in the posh Tokyo neighborhood of Ginza, so it attracts a lot of tourists and locals alike, and the women are successful. The women work very hard. The owners say they find the female chefs they've trained actually work much harder to impress them than the men they've trained as chefs. And this is a real example of a success story for hopefully more restaurants in Japan and elsewhere.
VOA's Lori London talking with reporter Amy Gutman. Happening now in Asia, Reuters reporters Wang Loon and Kyo So-woo were again included on a list of the 10 most urgent cases of journalists whose global press freedoms are being abused. The list, which is updated monthly, was put together by the One Free Press Coalition, a new group formed by news organizations to spotlight journalists under attack. You're listening to VOA Asia. We are happy you're with us. The United States and the Taliban have begun a new round of negotiations in Doha, Qatar, in an effort to advance peace efforts in Afghanistan and to urge the insurgent group to participate in an inclusive intra-Afghan dialogue. U.S. Special Reconciliation Envoy Zalmay Khalilzad is leading the team of American negotiators in the meeting with insurgent leaders based in the Qatari capital. A Taliban official told VOA the discussions would focus on fleshing out some remaining details of a preliminary draft agreement the two sides had reached in their last meeting in early March that continued for 16 days. The Taliban official, who spoke on condition of anonymity, anticipated further progress in the talks. If finalized, the U.S. Taliban agreement would bind the insurgent group to prevent transnational terrorist networks from using Afghan soil to harm other countries, and Washington, in turn, would agree to a timetable for withdrawal of all foreign troops from Afghanistan. Khalilzad, however, has repeatedly stated a comprehensive Taliban ceasefire and the rebel group's participation in intra-Afghan peace discussions would be key to concluding the deal. The Afghan government has been excluded from the dialogue because the insurgent group has maintained from the outset that it will not participate in any formal internal Afghan peace discussions until Washington agrees and announces a foreign troop withdrawal timeline. Prior to his arrival in Qatar, Ambassador Khalilzad held talks with leaders in Pakistan and sought their help to convince the Taliban to participate in intra-Afghan talks. As efforts to bring a negotiated solution to Afghanistan's 18-year-long war are apparently gathering steam, that country is hosting a Loya Jirga, a grand assembly of people to discuss the parameters of future negotiations with the Taliban. An American envoy is in the region to continue his ongoing negotiations with the militant group, as we just told you. While everyone hopes for peace, the artists of Afghanistan wonder how that peace will look for them if extremist Taliban share power. Under their rule in the 90s, music, films, painting, art was all banned. VOA's Aisha Tazim reports.
The art lords are busy painting the walls of Kabul. Most of the murals splashed around the city are the work of this grassroots collective found in 2014. They want to bring social transformation through art. Here, they're making the mural of Farhunda, a woman who was lynched by a mob after a cleric accused her of blasphemy. While they still self-censor in conservative Afghanistan, their work has increasingly become bolder and bolder. Next to me is a painting that the art lords are proud of, but would rather not show on camera because they think it's too controversial. And yet here is a painting they proudly display, even though during the Taliban era, this would have been prohibited. Across town, Roya Sadat is setting up her next shoot. She was the first female director in the post-Taliban Afghanistan. Since then, she has won international acclaim for her movies and TV serials. As negotiations with Taliban proceed, she is apprehensive.
One of our fundamental concerns is we don't know what Taliban think about this phenomenon and how they'll react to press, cinema, and music in Afghanistan.
Yet, as the United States negotiates with the Taliban, and while Afghanistan is hosting a traditional Loya Jirga, a grand assembly to discuss the parameters of future negotiations with the Taliban, the artist community feels they are watching from the sidelines.
So when it comes to inclusion in these kind of jirgas or talks or consultations, there's rarely times that they would ask an artist or an activist to be on the table. Usually they include you in a very general section of civil society activists, which some people might go to these jirgas. But I think for the artist itself, there's no seats available in such kind of discussions in Doha or Loya Jirga in Kabul. But as I said, we will find ways to bring our message on the table.
Sharifi said his hope lies with the young generation of Afghanistan who grew up with art and music around them and will not give it up. The Taliban, he said, will have to come to terms with this new Afghanistan. Aisha Tanzim, BOA News, Kabul.
Coming up, the latest in robots, one that could most likely beat you in ping pong. You're listening to BOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, Sri Lankan President Maithripala Sirisena said a foreign mastermind may have planned the Easter Sunday bombings claimed by Islamic State, telling the militant group to leave my country alone. Government source told Reuters Tuesday police and other security forces had been ordered to remain on high alert because the militants were expected to try to strike again. You're listening to VOA Asia. Britain's Prime Minister fired her defense minister Wednesday after finding compelling evidence that he leaked information to journalists about a secret decision to allow China's tech giant Huawei to participate in some parts of the country's 5G network. State Department correspondent Nike Ching reports the dismissal comes as the U.S. is renewing warnings about Huawei.
British Defense Chief Gavin Williamson was dismissed after the government blamed him for leaking a secret decision to allow Huawei to participate in the country's new 5G network. Britain is moving forward with Huawei despite U.S. warnings over the consequences, which were repeated by the top U.S. general before Congress Wednesday. Marine General Joseph Dunford is chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
If we're not mutually assured that that network is secure and we can exchange information, it's going to impede our ability to be allies and to share information as freely as we have in the past.
Britain is one of several European countries using Huawei's next-generation technology. That has opened up divisions with Washington, where lawmakers in both major parties are wary of the Chinese technology. Republican Senator Dan Sullivan is a member of Senate Armed Services Committee.
We don't want a 5G network that ultimately is controlled by the Communist Party of China. So that's one thing that I think we should be mindful of.
5G networks are expected to revolutionize communications. Excluding all Chinese equipment from these telecommunications systems may be too high a price to pay for many. David Dollar is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
If we say everything in telecom is critical infrastructure, well, we're going to be missing a lot of opportunities to import inexpensive, high-quality equipment.
Instead of cutting Chinese companies totally out of telecommunications, Dollar says there could be some sort of compromise for countries to use some basic Chinese equipment. But for now, no U.S. officials are openly discussing any such compromise. Nike Chin, VOA News, State Department.
This news alert from VOA Asia. North Korea has told the United States it will face undesired consequences if it fails to readjust its position on nuclear disarmament. It is the latest in a series of warnings to Washington and its allies in recent months. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. A new ping-pong-playing robot promises to teach new skills, demonstrating how robots can interact with humans in the workplace. Deanna Mitchell joins the game.
Forpheus is a giant robot, a robot that is really good at ping-pong. And surprisingly, its goal isn't to win the game. It is programmed to keep the game going, improving the skill of its human opponent, one rally at a time, with the help of artificial intelligence, or AI.
It is here to show everybody here that AI and robotics can be used to improve human skills.
In this case, the skill Forpheus is teaching is ping pong, and the robot isn't perfect.
Forpheus does miss because he's also learning. Forpheus is a learning AI algorithm where it's always trying to optimize for increased number of rallies, not decrease. So it's not about winning. The more rallies it can do with the player, the better, because that's the only way that a player is going to get more practice and more skills.
Omron, the Japanese electronics company that created Forpheus, is constantly improving its robot. This year, Forpheus is able to strike back with its own spins thanks to new elbow and wrist joints.
As I started spinning more and more, then it started spinning back. It was phenomenal. I was shocked.
How can this type of robot be used in the workplace?
So in this example, we have mobile robots that are running around simulating, bringing more product and more supplies to our human worker, making sure that they are kept up and productive.
This robot is able to understand which magnet someone is choosing and then give it to them.
In Forpheus, we're using a high-speed pick-and-place for ping pong. But in this case, we're using a high-speed pick-and-place to supply magnets to our attendees.
But Omron stresses the goal is to create robots that help humans work, not take their jobs.
We're very excited to bring the message of harmony between human and machines.
Omron is not saying what Forpheus's next step will be. Deanna Mitchell for VOA News, Las Vegas.
This is Science in a Minute.
During the early hours of this past January 21st, people in North and South America, as well as Western Europe, were able to enjoy the best view of a total lunar eclipse. Some observers were also treated to something quite rare, a meteorite striking the surface of the moon when the eclipse was starting to reach totality. The meteorite was seen as a tiny 0.28-second flash, which some say was bright enough to be seen with the naked eye. Two Spanish astronomers using the Moon Impacts Detection and Analysis System captured video footage of the impact. After analyzing the video, the scientists determined that the meteorite struck the moon at 61,000 kilometers an hour and left a crater between 10 to 15 meters across. They also calculated that the meteorite had a mass of about 45 kilograms and was 30 to 60 centimeters wide. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You can get our program on iTunes and SoundCloud, download our podcast, and take VOA Asia with you. Find us at voanews.com, and let's hear from you. VOA Asia Facebook and our email at voaasia@voanews.com. Thanks for being with us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Keith Holmes. Managing Editor Diane Gao and our VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. Also, our thank you to all of you listening through some of these radio stations, Radio Acton and Tamasek Polytechnic in Singapore, PSU Radio, FM 107.25, Prince of Tsongkhla University in Thailand. I'm Ira Melbourne in Washington. Enjoy your day.